And we'll go on to the middle chapter, which is called Mendel and the Gene Idea. Now, I don't have a feel for how famous Mendel is in the general public, since I've been talking about him as a biologist for so many years. Do people know who Gregor Mendel is? You've heard the name? Yes, definitely. Gregor Mendel is shown in this picture. He's not so famous that you know which one he is he? Well, he's the one right here. I think that's a pea plant he's looking at, actually. But as you see, he's photographed here with his fellow monks. He was a monk, lived in the 1800s in what is now Bosnia-Herzegovina. He lived in the Austrian Empire, that no longer exists, Austro-Hungarian Empire. Anyway, he figured a hell of a lot out about inheritance without having any idea what DNA is or a genes. This is way before we knew all that stuff. He had it figured out correctly. This is why we're still teaching what he figured out, because it's still correct. Even though he didn't have the benefit of modern knowledge. And that's remarkable in itself, but the reason that he had such success is because he was unusual for his day when it comes to biologists. This was back when biology was more of a descriptive science than an experimental science. Meaning that most biologists of the day were naturalists. They were people who would go out into nature and catalog everything about the surroundings. You know, name all the species of plants, animals, and whatever else. Catalog them, give them all names, give them all descriptions. It wasn't so much about running experiments, doing tests. Eventually that came later. But Mendel was experimental. And even just as importantly, he, unlike contemporaneous biologists of his time, he appreciated the importance of statistics. So not only was he doing tests, but he was using a lot of replicates. It's important not to just do something once when you're doing an experiment, right? You use a lot of subjects, and then you get averages and things like that. That wasn't appreciated by most biologists of the day. But without him doing a bunch of replicates, he would not have been able to figure out what he figured out. And he not only used a lot of replicates, but he did things very, very carefully and meticulously for years to get his results. And that's why he doesn't appreciate it, because he's dead now, but that's why we call him the father of genetics, Gregor Mendel. And genetics that occurs in a way that corresponds to what he figured out is called Mendelian genetics, in his honor. That's one of the major topics of this chapter, Mendelian genetics. That's just a picture of him, though. So let's go on to slide 2 and talk about how he conducted his experiments. He used pea plants, as you indicated, in all of his experiments. So he had many, many fields of peas that occupied pretty much all of his time for years. Pea plants are, more specifically, flowering plants, which in flowering plants, the flowers are the sexual organs of the plant. And pea plants, this isn't true of all flowering plants, but pea plants are examples of species in which the flower has both sexual organs, male and female parts. The female parts are called carpels. This bowling pin-shaped thing is a carpel. And in the bulb of that, you have the ovary that produces the eggs. So it's a gonad. The male parts are called stamens, these long, slender things. At the ends of them are these little sac-like structures called anthers that produce pollen. Pollen grains contain the sperm, the male gametes. And so, in nature, pea plants reproduce by having pollen from one flower land on the sticky end of a carpel. And when that happens, not only does the pollen stick, but the sperm cells that are in that pollen will bore a tunnel through the thickness, through the length of this carpel, get to the ovary eventually, and that allows a sperm to be delivered onto an egg in the ovary for fertilization to happen. That's how it happens in nature, and that's largely up to chance, whether the wind blows a certain way to get the pollen there or whether a bee happens to land. In other words, it's not that the plants aren't in charge because they're just sitting there. They don't meet each other, but their gametes meet. Well, Mendel didn't want to leave anything to chance. He wanted to be the boss of who reproduces with whom. So he had to carefully and meticulously go out and cut off the male stamens in certain batch of individual flowers so that they couldn't accidentally pollinate themselves. And then in a separate batch, which he was determining would be the fathers, he would carefully brush pollen from those anthers, or from those stamens, and then take them over to the batch that he cut off the male parts on, which he was deeming the mothers, basically, and carefully brush the pollen onto the tips of the carpels. So he was deciding which parent crossed with which parent. And that makes up what is called the P generation, P for parental. It includes the parents. Well, if that is successful, which you don't know right away, you have to be patient, then the flower will turn into a fruit, which is the offspring, which includes the offspring. A pea fruit, a pod of peas, includes the offspring themselves, which are the peas. These are not identical. These are siblings, brothers and sisters, but they're genetically different. Anyway, you can't tell much about the plants that they could come into be just by looking at the peas. So after waiting for that to happen, then you have to plant the peas and wait till the next year for them to grow up into plants themselves, and then you can take a look at the plants to get your results. That's called the first filial generation, or F1 generation. The direct offspring of the P generation is the F1 generation. And not shown here, but you could then do that again. You could cross an F1 with another F1 to produce the F2 generation, which he did. This takes years to do because you can't speed up the process of getting to the next season. All right, well, that's the basic technique he used in all seven of his experiments. He did the same technique thousands of times, but in seven batches of experiments. What was different about each experiment is what he paid attention to in each batch. In other words, the dependent variable was different in each of the seven batches, even though the technique of preparing the plants was exactly the same in all. And in slide 3, we see the results of one of those seven experiments. Now, I need to give you another couple definitions for this to make sense, for me to be able to talk about it. In everyday language outside of biology, the two words characteristic and trait are used more or less interchangeably. But in genetics, they are not interchangeable. They mean different things from each other. A characteristic can be just about anything describable about any given organism. Often it's something about how they look, and that's simply because humans are so visually oriented, but it doesn't have to be a visible characteristic. For instance, how quickly alcohol is digested is a characteristic. It's not something you look at to see, though, right? Something that's measurable. Anyway, that's a characteristic. It can be just about anything. A trait, on the other hand, is a specific value for that characteristic. But it's much better to just think about this in terms of an example first to get a feel for what I mean by those definitions. And a perfectly relatable human characteristic is hair color. That's a characteristic, hair color. But we know that there's not just one possibility, right? Red hair, auburn hair, black hair, whatever. Well, each of those individual colors of hair is a trait of the hair color characteristic. So a trait is a specific value for a characteristic. Does that make it more clear? Okay, well, based on those definitions, what is the characteristic in this first experiment of Mendel's?
Purple?
No, purple is not a characteristic. Purple is a trait. What is the corresponding characteristic? Flower color is the characteristic. Purple is one possible trait of flower color. White is another possible trait of flower color. So there's one characteristic here that we care about, and that's what I was saying earlier. In each of his seven experiments, even though there are thousands of characteristics that you could describe about pea plants, he ignored all of them except for one in each batch. In this batch, all he cared about was flower color. That's one characteristic. And a lot of the success of Mendel is attributable to the fact that he was so careful and meticulous and worked so hard. But it's also likely that he got a little bit lucky as well. Because in all seven of his experiments, each one was a different characteristic. There were only two possible traits for each of those characteristics. And that's not always true, like the hair color example I gave you, right? There's not just two hair colors in humans. Well, the more possible traits there are, the much more confusing the results get to understand, and he probably wouldn't have been able to figure that out, especially not having any idea what DNA is or how it works. So it's much simpler to figure out the numerical results if you have the situation in which there are only two traits possible for your chosen characteristic. And that's what he had in all seven of his experiments. In this one, there are exactly two traits for flower color, purple and white. Now, this is an example of a hybrid cross. A cross means one parent reproducing with another parent. But it's a hybrid cross if the two parents differ in their trait for the characteristic that's being tracked. So this isn't purple crossed with another purple or white crossed with another white. It's purple crossed with white. That's why it's a hybrid cross. And more specifically, it is a monohybrid cross. Mono meaning one is appropriate here because in a monohybrid cross, exactly one characteristic is tracked. You ignore all other characteristics. And the two parents differ in their traits for that one characteristic. Just like here. Now he had to work years before he could even get to the point of starting because he had to make sure he was using true breeding parents. A true breeding purple flowered plant is one that will always produce only purple flowered offspring when you reproduce it with other purple flowered individuals. And similarly for white. Well, doing that, making sure of that requires you going through several generations and ensuring that you never see a white one if you're dealing with purple flowered population. So that's all just preparation work. But once he was convinced that he had true breeding parents, he crossed the two types. That was the pea generation. Those produced the peas, then he planted the peas, then he waited for the next season, plants grew up, and they looked at those flowers. That's the F1 generation. And this first result immediately is already kind of surprising when you think about it. Because way before Mendel, for thousands of years already, humans had realized that offspring are kind of like a combination of both parents. Right? Kind of like a blending of their traits. And so it would be reasonable, based on that experience, to predict that the F1 generation would have not purple flowers or white flowers, but purplish white flowers. That's not what happened, though. There were no white flowers, and this is an important thing about doing it many, many times. If you did it just once, and you don't get a white flower, it could just be by chance, right? But he did it 1,000 times. And not a single white-flowered individual occurred in the F1 generation. All of them were purple, but not only that, all of them were fully purple. Every one of the F1 flowers was just as purple as the purple pea, the purple parent. So they weren't purplish white, they were fully purple. And no white at all. That's interesting in itself, but he didn't stop there. He then crossed F1 with another F1 hundreds of times. In other words, brother and sister with each other to produce the F2 generation. Well, those made their own peas, then he had to plant those and wait till the next season to get the F2 to grow up and look at their flowers. And when he did that, this is what he found. You can see his real numbers here, 705 and 224, so roughly 1,000 times. First of all, white-flowered individuals reappeared. They were in the P generation, not at all in the F1 generation. Now they are reappearing in the F2 generation. And also, he noticed that almost exactly 3/4 of the 1,000 or so that he counted in his F2 generation were purple and fully purple, and about 1/4 were white. So there's a 3-to-1 ratio in the F2 generation of two types of traits here. This brings up another couple definitions. There are dominant traits, and there are recessive traits. Since we're talking about just one characteristic, there's one dominant trait and one recessive trait. And in this specific example, purple is dominant over white. But the word recessive, that is an adjective form of recede, which means to hide, because that's what it seems like whiteness is doing. It was there in the P generation, hidden in the F1 generation, and then comes back out in the F2. That's why it was called the recessive trait. The dominant trait, though, dominates over the recessive trait, meaning it's easier if you have the dominant version of DNA for your trait to be dominant. The thing that you actually notice about the organism, the trait itself. Whereas it's more difficult to have the recessive trait. We'll talk more about why that's true based on DNA eventually. But this 3-to-1 ratio in a monohybrid cross, in the F2 generation of a monohybrid cross, is not something special about flower color. Like I said, he did the same technique but paid attention to a different characteristic in each of his 7 experiments. And those are shown in slide 4. each row is a different experiment, so he was using different fields of plants, paying attention to just one characteristic in each one. This one's flower color, this one's flower position on the plant, seed color, and so on. He did each one of them hundreds or thousands of times, and noticed that in each case, there was this almost exactly 3-to-1 ratio of dominant trait to recessive trait in the F2 generation. Well, he wouldn't have been able to tell that if he'd only done it 2 or 3 times. You have to have big numbers for averages to be actually close to the truth. Right now, I won't talk about the math involved there, but that's why he had to be so careful. And no other biologist, or effectively no other biologist of his time, was doing that. Well, he produced his paper, published his paper, and it was basically ignored until well after he was dead. But now he's the father of genetics. I'll end it there because what's on 5 I'll talk about. It's kind of a switch in topics. Not really, but it's a good place to stop.